All right. Tonight, what I'd really, begin with, are there any questions from last week? Anybody have any thoughts? Or knowing now that this is your last class, is there any questions you would like to ask before I start? Either I'm teaching you really well or not. I don't know which one it is because you have so few questions. I don't know, sometimes that's a good sign, sometimes that's a terrible sign. I don't know which way to take it. What I want to share with you all tonight is I had said something about how I was going to organize this class at the beginning, but I also said at the time, maybe I won't, and I didn't. So just and just disregard whatever you might have heard about what I was going to do. It was all wrong. What I'm going to talk about now is a few sort of rules of relating to people, insofar as there are rules, I would call them guidelines more, that I think I originally took this list off of some classes that Swamiji gave many years ago. And I really find them to be the essential, fundamental attitudes that if you can get them in place, everything else follows. I guess it was Joycey last week who asked me the question about communication. How important is communication, she said, and I was a little stymied for a moment. I didn't know how to answer. When I really reflected on it, I realized this, and I'm going to back up to say what I'm about to say, which is really simple. Years ago, Swamiji wrote rules of conduct for Ananda members. Since then, it has been more accurately titled guidelines because it's called Rules of Conduct, and it's just this little 30-page booklet, which is for sale over there. And there wasn't a single rule in it. In fact, almost none of it even related to anything specific. It was all about getting the right attitude. Because once you got the attitude right, then you automatically know what to do. But even if you're doing the right thing, if you have the wrong inner attitude, people are not stupid. They pick it up. They know what you're really thinking, no matter how nice you really are. I had this long, crazy intermediation I had to do between these two people in which one had been offended by something the other did, but the one who had caused the offense kept repeating to me everything that they'd said and pointing out to me why none of it was offensive. And then somewhere way into the process, she admitted that she'd had all these terrible negative thoughts and was really had a really stinky attitude toward this other person and had just spoken nicely. I said, well, for heaven's sakes, you think you can just like, your thoughts aren't a reality? Do you think that especially people at Ananda, but really everyone in the world, but certainly other people who meditate are intuitive, they don't even hear what you say because what you're radiating is so powerful that it completely obliterates what you say. That's that old adage, what you are speaks so loudly, I can't hear what you're saying. But in our relationships with people, it's true that there are lots of rules you can develop for how to relate. There's a whole marvelous system called nonviolent communication, which is just all about the nuances. And Swami Kriyananda himself puts enormous attention to how you say something. I recall once we were trying to work out some situation that I was involved in, and he was repeating to me, he was bringing me up to date about certain interactions he'd had with someone. And just because he was talking quickly, he made a certain statement, and so then I said so and so. He said, although I didn't say it like that because that's accusatory, he said, and I'm never accusatory. It was just so simple. He said, I never accuse someone of anything because that completely sets up a whole dynamic that changes the way things are. So don't underestimate the importance of what you actually say, but don't overestimate it either. If your heart is mean-spirited and your mind is mean-spirited, you can honeycoat it as much as you like. People will just feel what you really are. And you can protest your innocence till you're blue in the face. You aren't innocent, period. Thoughts are things. Consciousness is more powerful than matter. I recall in one instance, this is a little bit off the subject, but I was accused of doing something I hadn't done. And these consequences ensued from the accusation, and I hadn't done it. I was absolutely innocent. I would have done it, but it turned out that I hadn't done it. And I finally decided I was just getting caught for something I'd gotten away with on some other occasion, even some other incarnation. It was in me to have done the wrong thing in exactly the way I was being accused. The mere fact that I was innocent was completely irrelevant because in my consciousness, I was capable of it. So I just decided to just quit protesting and just accept with good grace. I mean, that's the fundamental basis by which the guru disciplines us. And if we begin to think that everything that comes to us is really coming to us from God and guru, then we get far less concerned about the facts. Because if we didn't have some vibration that would bring this event to us, it wouldn't come to us. Now, that doesn't mean, and we have to be clear about this, that you should always be a doormat. But when you find yourself protesting too vigorously that you didn't do it, that you are innocent, just pause a moment and ask yourself how innocent you really are. Factually, you may be innocent, but are you really innocent in consciousness? And ultimately, but this has to be sincere, and it has to be the right response for us, and I can expand on that if I need to. Ultimately, as Swamiji puts it himself, very simply, I refuse to defend my ego, is how he put it. I do not live to maintain my ego. I live to overcome it. I refuse to defend it. And he just won't. Even when we were in this lawsuit situation, it was a terrible dilemma for him because it was absolutely against his principles to defend himself. And he only agreed even to have his deposition taken because he was not solitary in the impact. If he had not been willing to cooperate with the process of being sued, then Ananda, all of us, would have been impacted by that. So he agreed. But he was a terrible witness because he just would answer truthfully, but there was just, he wouldn't put out anything to correct the impression, if you know what I mean. He would just state the facts in such an impassive way that you had to really know him to understand what was going on. But he couldn't. He just simply couldn't. Because for him, that's really the stage that he's at. Some of us are at the stage where it's important for us to stand up for ourselves. So there's a lot of different things going on. And I'll put that in my rules, which is the word appropriate, which I'll spend more energy on now. Okay. Last week I talked a little bit about, not a little bit, I talked almost the whole time about trust and who to trust and how to trust the right things. And that really is the fundamental underlying attitude that puts all your relationships in right relationship to you, is that you're seeing everyone in your life as being an expression of something much more profound, of which they themselves may or may not be conscious, but nonetheless, that is the reality that they are expressing. And you're not hanging the weight of your security, your happiness, your optimism on anybody's consciousness, which, as Swamiji said, there's only two reasons why people incarnate in this world. One is that you are a perfect master and you are an avatar with no karma and you come to help others. The other is that you have some karma to work out. And if you're an avatar or in association with them, you will probably know. Alternatively, you can absolutely depend that everybody that you encounter is here to learn lessons. And yet, aren't we shocked when their failings come out? Don't we feel just so betrayed? Can you imagine how ridiculous that is? Like, what did we expect? You know, that we were in contact with an avatar? Of course not. We're with somebody who hopefully is sincere, and we should judge carefully. We should discriminate and not associate with people whose consciousness is too base. You know, Swamiji puts it in a really interesting way. He says quite simply, the way Master puts it is, whenever two consciousnesses meet, there is an exchange of magnetism. And whoever has the stronger magnetism will influence and overcome the other. And therefore, if we are in contact with a downward moving magnetism that is greater than our power to resist, or greater definitely than our power to convert, we should get away from it. Because otherwise we lose everything. You know, it's the way Master put it, he said, if you're faced with the test that you know you're going to fail, he said the wisdom is to run away from it. Just to run away from it. Because if we constantly allow ourselves to be defeated by circumstances, several things happen. One is we get weaker and weaker. And the other thing that happens is we begin to get a self-image of ourselves as a person who can't succeed. And once that begins, you really start a spiral downward, which is terrible. Now, I understand sometimes the magnetism that is overwhelming you is your own relatives. You know, your family, your children, your spouses. It can be people who you think you can't get away from. So sometimes getting away from them is about your consciousness and how you deal with your own consciousness to protect yourself from individuals. So I'm not going to really go into that a lot because it's a bit of a specialized area. But that all falls under the concept of you have to relate appropriately. And appropriately is to recognize what the real goal of life is, which is self-realization, and you have to be appropriate in how you respond to that, and you have to be appropriate about yourself. I'm on the word appropriate. It doesn't come till later, but I'm going to use it now. Okay, the single most important thing in your relationships with people is to be appropriate. It's not to be nice. It's not to come across looking like a saint. It's not to be supportive. None of those things. It's to be appropriate. Because very often the appropriate response is, get out of my house, take everything that's yours, don't ever come back. Sometimes that's absolutely the appropriate response. It's not nice. Jesus drove the money changers out of the temple with a whip. He was not always nice. Of course, he had the right to, that was his father's house, and he had the right to defend it from desecration. That's the level on which he operated. But this is your father's house. Your consciousness is your divine temple. You have the right to defend it. Nobody has the right to take it over. At other times, what's appropriate is for you or me to give up our self-interest in order to help someone. If the full evaluation of the picture is that's what's being asked of me. That's forward movement for me spiritually. Because the whole question is, what is forward movement? Oh my goodness, I just realized what I never put on the board. I have to do this, I guess. Okay, because here's how you tell what's appropriate. We may only talk about appropriate tonight. You may remember in some other class, was it Healing the Heart, where I talked about the four castes? I think that's what it was. The whole thing about relating to other people is to understand for ourselves and for them what is forward motion. Okay? Because the goal of life, as I started to say, is to be appropriate, but it's to be appropriate in the sense that we need to free ourselves from compulsive behavior. We have to be free in the way we respond to life. I think instead of the four castes, what I actually want to talk about is a simple thing about direction of energy. And I know some of you who have sat in other of my classes have heard this before, because we only ever talk about the same things. When I was talking about the goal of life is to be free, there's really two directions of our energy. One is contractive and one is expansive. And what is expansive or contractive for you as an individual or for the people that you're in relationship to depends quite simply on where they're standing. When I was 18 years old, I realized that I did not have the capacity to stand strong against opposition, believe it or not. I just would wilt when people would escalate the conflict. You know, people would speak strongly or insultingly to me, or it was required that I raise my voice. I could never deal with that. Peace at any price was pretty much the way I went at things. Until I realized that I called that spiritual positive behavior, and in its appearance, it appeared to be harmonious. I appeared to be a harmonious person, an easygoing person. I could get along with this. This was a little interlude in my life from the age of 18 to 24. I sort of lived out this little other alter ego of myself. I didn't have opinions about anything. People who knew me then didn't know. People who knew me before and after could never figure out that period, but nonetheless, there it was. And it was very helpful for many reasons for me. But somewhere in the middle of that, I began to realize that what appeared to be a harmonious behavior was actually extremely fear-based behavior. And the more I behaved harmoniously, the more I was emphasizing this kernel. See, I had all these harmonious waves, you know, these nice, sweet energies. But at the kernel of it was not a free, happy feeling toward other people, but there was this enormous fear that if I displeased anyone or stood up for anything, then god-awful things would happen to me. So the harmonious behavior, which for someone else who maybe had an uncontrolled temperament and just learned temper and just needed to learn to relax and not get so upset about things, and calming down would be expansive for them. For me, to continue to be so afraid and not be willing to just totally freak out if the energy got even a little agitated, for me to continue in that way was contractive, because the core of it was false. Do you see what I mean? So a hot-headed person needed to calm down, but a frightened person needs to learn to speak up. Because I wasn't free, I was totally afraid, and I needed to expand into other ways of behaving without feeling like it was the end of the world. So that's a simple example, we understand that. I was living in New York City at the time. I lived in New York City for one summer. Perfect place to learn to just stand up for yourself. Because, you know, everybody's just so insulting in New York. And it doesn't mean anything to them. It's just the way they behave. I'm a laid-back California girl, you know, just nice. And they're just like, hey, what are you doing, buddy? Why are you cutting in line? What you doing there? And just that kind of energy, which I just like, would just panic me. And people would just be that noisy and rude and just overbearing. I just couldn't bear it. I would just shrink like a little wilted snail. And just the simple act of learning to just live comfortably in New York City and behave like a New Yorker was extremely liberating for me. You know, this was not in me a real deep neurosis. It was more like a habit of behavior. But it was very interesting how important it was for me to be able to just be as loud and insulting as I needed to be, which was nothing that I would have called spiritual or would have wanted. I kept it up for the whole summer until I began to enjoy it. Then I decided that I'd gone enough, and I went back to something that was more natural to me. But that's why sometimes people who, for example, were badly raised, often people who are adult children of alcoholics, have a very fragmented sense of themselves. And when they come into spiritual groups where people say, well, you should not, you know, you should be selfless, you should give to others, that's not good advice for an adult child of alcoholics who hasn't yet realized their own self-worth and can stand up and just say what their truth is. Sometimes such a person needs to be very opinionated about everything and not give in on any point, no matter how small it is, until they have established their right to have an opinion. And that could be appropriate behavior for them because it's expansive. Whereas someone like myself, at the present stage of my life and for quite a few years, who has a great affection for my own opinions, as I was saying in one of these services, I love my own ideas. I think I just love them. You know, I don't need to always be asserting them. I'm like really, really good at asserting my own ideas. I need to just listen. Let other people have the limelight. Let them say what they need to say. Go along with other people's ways of doing things. That, for me, is expansive because the other is just, it's so ingrained in me, there's no forward progress in it. And so depending on who you're relating to, and I talked about this, I think, in the first class, you have to see people for what their reality is. If somebody's consistently taking advantage of you, you're not helping them by being nice. You're not helping them by giving them the impression that they can do anything they want and it's okay with you. That's just completely foolish. At the end of my first marriage, which I referred to, you know, earlier in these classes, I talked about how I got much stronger through that relationship because I was very self-sacrificing in it. But my husband got weaker. And we talked about that later. I said, I spoiled you. He said, you did. Because I just gave him the impression that, you know, people, he could just have his way. And I just always cooperated with him. And it just gave him a very wrong impression of how people would relate to him. And he had to learn a lot of things after I wasn't living with him anymore, because I had spoiled him in the way I treated him. I did not respond appropriately. There were many times when it was right for me to have said, I'm sorry, dear. You know, I love you. You're a wonderful person, but I'm not going to go along with that. That's just wrong. Or why would you think I would do that? You know, it's just not right. Because it wasn't expansive to allow him to just think that the world would just go along with him. Of course, there are much worse examples of abusive behavior, alcoholic behavior, just taking behavior. Sometimes children get in that relationship with their parents. They just think their parents are just there to give to them all the time. Doesn't make any difference. My sister tells this story about her son. Her son, who's really a character, he was about 6 or 7, maybe about 6 years old, maybe a little younger. And they were in the car, and she said later, this was really her fault, because he had an indelible marking pen in his hand, and she should have just taken it away from him. Instead, he took the cap off, and he was about to mark his shirt, and she said, you know, don't do that. And he did, just deliberately marked his shirt. She said, now you've ruined the shirt. Where will you get another one? How will we get another one? He said, Daddy will buy it for me. So she was not fond of that attitude of his at all. So he was a small enough child at that point not to have a sense of real sense of money, but he had a piggy bank, and he considered the worth of the piggy bank to be the quantity of coins in it. He couldn't differentiate between a penny and a quarter, so he must have been really quite young. But the sheer quantity of it. So she said, all right, Daddy's not about to buy you another shirt. You ruined it yourself. He works hard for the money he earns. You're going to buy a new shirt for yourself. So she took his piggy bank, and they went to the Kmart or somewhere, and she led him to the right price of shirt. And, you know, he was just going along with this. And they picked it out, and then they came to the counter. Then she takes his piggy bank, and she turns it over, and she starts with the pennies and just starts counting. And he begins to see that most of his piggy bank is going to go to this shirt. He's a very strong-minded child. He just begins to throw a tantrum. He's screaming. He's kicking. He's pounding on the counter. She's just counting his pennies. This is all in the public store. You know, everybody's around. She has a lot of willpower. She's just counting his pennies. He just becomes more and more hysterical. She just made him give his entire piggy bank for that shirt. I said, did he learn? She says, I don't know. Later he kept saying, this is the shirt I bought for myself. She said she didn't know if she was going to get arrested before she came out of Kmart, you know. But, you know, that was like, you have to go right in there and you have to respond. People can't, you know. Anyway, I love that story. She's so good. She did a great job with that guy. I forgot where I started with that, but I think it was not spoiling, just being appropriate. Okay, you can often see it with children. Oh, I was saying, children begin to think that their parents are there just to give to them. And they just don't have any understanding. And we have a little bit of that problem in our school. You know, we want the children to earn more money, like for our field trips and things like that. But children are so overscheduled. You know, we try to communicate that they ought to earn some of the money that they spend at Ananda Village. I don't know if they still have this, but Nitai had a rule that any child who came to the high school had to earn a certain percentage of their own tuition. He just wouldn't let them come just on their parents' check. Whether he still does that or not, I don't know. But he just thought it was bad for them. You know, they needed to get some relationship between work and money. When I made a list of what I thought our school should teach children, that was very high on the list. They need to understand the relationship between work and money. But no matter who it is in your life, if they're not behaving appropriately, you're not being spiritual by not letting them know that. You're being, in some way or another, contractive. And if you look at it, there's probably some kernel of wrong attitude inside what you might be able to justify as right behavior. Now, of course, if you're going to rearrange heaven and earth, you need to do it a little slowly, because you might not have the magnetism to handle an earthquake that's going to shift it from night to morning. You have to think about, part of behaving appropriately is to be realistic about what people can handle. And this is another one of the little rules that's really important here, is that you have to think in terms of doing that which is useful to other people. Now, well, let me just say which is useful, because it's to everybody, including yourself. It's not just to others. But you have to think of that which is useful and practical and will really have an effect. And balancing yourself in it, sometimes, as I say, you just have to throw the bums out and just take the consequences and go on your own. But if in terms of feeding back to people, especially in terms of giving people advice or guiding them or in any way responding to their energy, you want to think, let me do that which is helpful and useful. And that's not the same as just saying what's true, because a lot of times the facts of a matter are neither helpful nor useful, because the facts of the matter are that we're all in delusion and we're just all complete idiots, but a great deal of the time, it doesn't do any good to just say that. That's what we've lived through with Swami Kriyananda over the years. He himself said, I wrote this in the book also. He said, years ago, this was the situation, was he gave a very strong correction to someone who works with him a lot. He corrected him very strongly in front of others. And afterwards, Swamiji said, "I hope I didn't hurt your feelings." He knew that the man wanted correction and was willing to take it. He said, "I hope I didn't hurt your feelings," he said, "but I don't know how much time I have left." He said, "It used to be years ago I could say something to someone and give them a decade to digest it and then say something else." He said, "But now I don't know how much time I have left, and I want to help you all as much as I can." And Swami has become a lot more frank, and he speaks up a lot more often, and he says a lot more clearly exactly what he means, because none of us have that much time. But for a long time, and still I know he never tells someone more than they can handle. Because the whole point is, and I was saying this before, if a test is too big for you, run away from it. Life is entirely about maintaining your positive attitude and your momentum. Really, when I say be useful and helpful to people, think about it. This was very clear in an interchange I had with David when we were very early in our relationship, in our marriage together. I was just moving into something I did for the years, a few years before we came here. We've been here 20 years. We've been married 25, so this was in those first 5 years. I was starting to travel and teach. That was it. And I had to set up these lectures on the West Coast mostly. I never went to the East at that time. And I had two reasons for hesitating to just really bring things to a clear and final focus. One was that I was a procrastinator, just pure and simple. And the second was I just hated to commit myself into the future. I always like to be able to readjust my options according to my pleasure. And having to say that in 3 months I would be there and there and there and there was really hard for me. Largely because of Swami Kriyananda's role in my life. I always wanted to be unscheduled for his sake. Like I'm canceling this class on Tuesday. Anyway, but as a consequence, things were backing up a little bit and it was getting a little dicey. David has a completely different temperament. He really likes, he doesn't like to be pressured, and he's very disciplined at being able to just focus on what needs to be done and doing it. So he's always way ahead rather than behind. He just, something needs to be decided, he'll decide it. I look at it, think about it, wait a little while, think about it again, you know. I tend to make very last-minute decisions even now. So he became quite concerned because he could see the time was passing and I still didn't, you know, really have this together. And so he tried to help me by explaining to me what a god-awful mess it was going to be if I didn't get my act together. You know, but the reason I wasn't acting as I should have was because I was nervous and afraid. Just afraid of committing, afraid of making the wrong decisions, afraid of bringing things to a clear focus. All the procrastination was based on fear. So he increased my fear, thinking that if I got scared enough, I would act. He didn't understand, because it was not his temperament at all, that the more fearful I got, the more paralyzed I became. Swami contrasted me with a very good friend of mine. He said, "When you don't know what to do, Asha, you do nothing." He said, "When this other person doesn't know what to do, she does twice as much." You know, it's just like some people get afraid and they act. I just would become paralyzed. Thank God, that's not my temperament anymore, but it was strongly that 25 years ago. But I was astute enough to realize that even though he was trying to be helpful, because that's his motivation, why make a mess? Just figure it out. Because he wasn't afraid to make decisions. It's just like, why get yourself in trouble? Just solve it now. That the more he spoke, the more scared I got. And finally, I was able to say to him, "Honey, I know all that. It's all those thoughts that have me paralyzed. If you want to help me, just say things like, 'You're wonderful, I know you can do it.'" In other words, ease my fear. You know, just give me an environment in which I feel secure and competent, and then all the things that are paralyzing me will go away. And to his credit, never, not once since that time, has he done anything except be supportive. I can see it in his face sometimes. He'll cross his face like, "Are you crazy?" But he never says it. He'll just be really supportive of me because he understands it doesn't work for me. It's not useful. He may be getting nervous because he sees that, because our lives are so intertwined, that if I don't get my act together, it's going to be a mess for him. And on occasion, he's essentially told me that he can't handle it unless I make this decision. But still, it's the right thing to say because it's useful. You see? And so you have to deal with people and understand not just what your reality is in this situation, but what theirs is. Because as long as people feel loved and safe, they can actually do anything. Almost everyone knows exactly what they ought to do. There are very few people who don't know what they ought to do. But we don't do it because we're afraid. Almost universally, it's some form of fear that prevents us from doing what we ought to do. And as long as you can just keep a person's energy moving in a positive, energetic, enthusiastic way. Swami defines ahimsa, nonviolence, or the opposite of it, is when you kill somebody's enthusiasm or confidence in themselves. Swamiji, among the many qualities that he has, his genius as a leader, is that no matter what the circumstances, he can always look at a person and recommend to them some doable step that will move them forward. And that alone, just simply that, just think of that. Every time you go to him, he'll recommend something that you actually can do that will move you forward. One time someone presented, Swamiji had given them advice that turns out they couldn't live up to it. The person went back and said, Swamiji, I can't do what you asked me. His response, instantaneous, so much for theory, let's deal with reality. You know, no, just be strong, do it anyway. He just looked and he saw, not possible. So let's just think about, you know, what we can really do. Now, of course, to work with him, just speaking of him, effectively, you have to be honest. Because if you're not honest with him, if you try to pretend with him, then he's not going to interfere. He's not going to break down your ego resistance. But with other people, too, you have to realize people, number one, may not understand themselves enough to present themselves accurately, and they may not have the nerve to do it anyway. So it's not just a question of what people say to you. I made that mistake really early on. I thought if people asked for my advice, they wanted it. Oh, dear. One of my friends said to me so sweetly, dear Asha, she said, you explain my problems more clearly than I want to know them. And Swami's words to me were, Asha, people don't really want to know. But you see, then I started thinking about myself, and I realized how devastated I was sometimes when people just spoke too frankly to me. You know, think about it. How often is it taken you weeks to recover when somebody just says some simple truth? But we're very, very fragile beings. And you don't help people just by telling them the truth. You help people by giving them the courage to go forward. That's what helps people. Now, sometimes it is appropriate. You just have to say the frank and simple truth. Maybe it's because it's the only thing you can handle at that point. Because we too are important in this equation. I was saying earlier, just at the beginning about this, about not having a class next week, that, you know, I know my own limits. I drove back on both Sundays this last weekend and gave Sunday service, and I did it cheerfully. I enjoyed the whole experience. It was fine. Last year, for Swami's birthday, I announced to David, I can't do it. And we closed the church. Because I didn't know if he'd ever come back. I thought it was his last birthday. We just didn't have a Sunday service because we couldn't ask anybody else to do it, and I couldn't do it. It was just beyond me. So it was a sacrifice I couldn't make. So there are times in our lives when we have to say to someone, it's a sacrifice I can't make. To put up with this, to hold my tongue, whatever it might be, but that's appropriate. That's the appropriate response, because you're an equal part of the equation. What I've observed, the way I define this useful appropriateness, is everybody is equal. And if you have the capacity to put aside your own needs and desires, and you can do it joyfully, and it's a genuine love offering, then by all means, do it. We're not here to indulge our desires and our ego. It's not why we were born. We were here to expand beyond it and to ultimately transcend it. And as long as you can do it joyfully, go right ahead. There's no limit to how self-sacrificing you should be until it begins to feel like a sacrifice. At which point it's no longer appropriate. At which point it may be time for somebody else to adjust to you. Because it's not appropriate. It disturbs the balance of truth in the world if one person gives up more than they ought to give up. They, you know, we have words for it. It's called enabling, you know, things like that. But those are true concepts. So we have to be useful also to ourselves and appropriate. I was just thinking this afternoon about some leadership advice that Swamiji gave to what we call the Ananda Colony leaders, which is people in the 7 or 8 communities that we have that have the position that David and I do, where we have this overall responsibility for the direction of everything that the Ananda entity there is doing. And Swamiji was just giving some general advice in a very casual way, but it was so beautifully stated. He said, because we ourselves are not liberated, because this is merely a responsibility we've been given for the sake of our working out our own karma, he said it would be presumptuous not to take your own spiritual welfare into account when you make decisions. Now, what that means is, he said, even if a certain decision might be the right decision from the point of view of the organization, if it's wrong for you spiritually, don't make it. For example, he said, maybe somebody needs to be treated sternly, but that sternness would corrupt your own heart. He said, then be charitable. Even if sternness would be more appropriate, if it's not appropriate for you to be stern, be charitable. Isn't that interesting? But you see, that keeps the whole thing on the level of Dharma. At every point, we're just responding appropriately. And where there is Dharma, there is always victory. And to be able to have faith in that is because we're trusting God, not other people. We're trusting that if I behave appropriately, according to the highest that I understand, that somehow or another it will all work out. I can't tell you how many times in my life I've had to act just on that basis in my interactions with people. That this, I know it's the right thing. I do not know how it's going to work out, but I know that it will. I don't mean to say that everybody's always happy. Sometimes people are not happy. You know, you've just done something and they're mad about it. Sometimes they remain mad at you for a long, long time. Sometimes your so-called relationships fall apart. But sooner or later, it just reveals itself to be all right if you behave sincerely. You don't even have to have been right, as long as you were sincere in your attempt to be right. So someone wrote Swamiji once and asked, you know, what she should do about a very difficult situation. She said she was praying and praying and couldn't get an answer. Swamiji's answer was, do anything you like. God is pleased that you have a sincere desire to do the right thing. And so sometimes, you know, we really don't have a very clear idea, but this is just what we have to do. I've done things many times where I've said, I don't know if this is right or not, but it's the only thing I can do. It's the only thing that's occurred to me to do, or it's the only thing I can do with sincere good energy. After that, think about if it's useful, if it's going to be helpful to other people. There's so much wrong teaching nowadays. Stand up for yourself, speak your mind, get it off your chest, you know, don't suppress it. But we can say hurtful things to people that decades later they still haven't forgiven. You know, are just random spouting of whatever's in our heads can be terribly detrimental. One has to think of the impact of one's words and the impact of the revelations, and as much as possible, think very carefully about how this will affect others within the balance of all that I've said. What does this person really need to hear from me? Swamiji talked about an experience with Master where there was this devotee who really liked to be with Master. He was a famous Hollywood singer, I think, at the time. And he loved to be with Master, and then he would act like he was really interested in learning the teachings and meditating, and he would make these appointments with Swamiji. Often Swamiji had to drive across town to meet him, but he would never show up. So Swami became quite put off by him. He felt he was insincere. So the man came to visit Master, and Swamiji was present, and Swamiji was very cool toward him, thought that was the right behavior. You haven't respected me, I'm not going to respect you. Afterwards, Master said, you were very cool to him. And Swami explained, well, he's not sincere, he's just with you for the glamour, he's like this. And Master replied, he said, how would you all have fared if I had treated you like that? You know, it's like it was Master's constant warmth. And the next time this man came to visit, I think I have the sequence of this wrong, but the context was Master said something like, well, we'll have fun with him this time. And Master's way of having fun with him was to just pour out more love to him. Now, that wasn't that Master was incapable of being stern, but he looked at the man and knew that sternness would not win him. that whatever was keeping him from taking the next step would not be solved by sternness, but it would be solved by loving and just being more welcoming and more kind. Sometimes it's solved by sternness. I've seen Swamiji be very stern. I remember one situation which, you know, you look at things from the outside, it's only because Swamiji would explain himself to me that I was able to learn and then understand. But I recall this, Swamiji and I were, this woman and I were sitting at a table together at some event, and Swami sat down with us, and he and the other woman just exchanged a couple of words, and then Swami just abruptly got up and walked away. And, you know, I couldn't help but think, that was awfully rude. Swami's not rude. Why was he like that? Later on, he essentially said to me, as he described it, was that this woman was demanding, essentially, that Swamiji accept a wrong reality that she was trying to impose. And he wasn't about to do it. And when he saw that she was still just resisting and holding this wrong thought, he just had to demonstrate to her, I'm not going to accept that from you. And all of that happened on a level that I couldn't perceive. But he just, you know, essentially wanted to say, are you open to the truth? She made it clear that she wasn't, and he just had no reason to relate to her. He just stood up and walked away. I mean, they eventually resolved it because she was a very close-in soul. But, you know, it was just like, what enormous sensitivity. But that was the appropriate response. If you're with someone and they're demeaning to you and they're insulting to you, it's not necessarily a good idea to scream and shout at them, but you can just walk away. You know, because why would you put up with that? To scream and shout at them, however, could be very bad for you because it could reinforce in you all kinds of bad qualities. Maybe there's a point at which you need to say, I will not tolerate this from you anymore. Or maybe you just need to act. Just get up and walk away. You don't always have to be nice. The expansive gesture may be to have the courage simply to do that. Or the expansive gesture may be for you to just, you know, pick up a china vase and break it over their head, you know? It just may really be exactly what you need to do. You can't be afraid of what is going to free your soul. However, this is another one of the rules. Be very wary of strong emotions. Strong emotions tend not to be clarifying. They tend to be very, very confusing in a situation. Whenever we realize that we've just moved out of our ability to be centered and objective, that doesn't mean you don't consciously hiss. I had this relationship with this woman that I was working with, and she was a Scorpio. I've had a lot of Scorpio friends in my life, and Scorpios, they sting. You know, things are happening, and they just sort of, they don't like what's happening, so they'll make what I call a preemptive strike. They'll just come out and bite you, because that's how they function in the world. I've always been able to get along with Scorpios pretty well, because I'm not that easy to offend. And so I don't mind that much. I'm very quick with my own sharp little tongue, and we can just go back and forth. But this was a Scorpio friend of mine, a very good friend, very dear friend. And we were working on a project, a group of us, which is very, very pressured. We were under deadline, and we were working really hard, and everybody was just, it was a big story, a day and night story. So it was in the middle of producing The Path. You know the book, The Path? Swamiji finished writing it, went to India for a seclusion for 6 months, and he left it in the hands of the publication staff, and I was in charge of getting that book to the printer, and then there was a whole group of people who we were all working. I was the coordinator of it. By no means was I the only one, because there were many people who were much more knowledgeable than I, but I was the coordinator, sort of the point person. One of the people working on it, the Scorpio lady, my dear friend, just got, you know, she's just getting more and more overwrought over the long hours and all the pressure, and we were in, at that time, what is now Hansa Temple was then the publications building, and there was a stairwell that went right up the middle of the building. There was the top floor, and I guess there were just two floors. Seems to me like, I was thinking there were three, but I think there were just two. But the stairwell went up that. She was down in the basement, and I was up above, and she just started, we were having a conversation, and she started heating up and just started getting louder and more aggressive and more off balance. And I'm standing there and I'm thinking, she just needs to have a fight with someone, you know, and she might as well fight with me because I'm not the least bit mad at her. And she could take this out on someone else, you know, and it could just break things up for a really long time. So she started yelling at me. I raised my voice to be a little louder than hers. She raised hers above me. I raised mine above hers. We're just right in the middle of all this stuff that's going on. But I never lost my center. I just looked at it and I thought, this is appropriate behavior at this point, is that we need to fight. So we just had this sort of screaming match until it crested. Then she sort of giggled a little, I laughed a little, and the whole thing just went down and everything just went on beautifully. If I hadn't had the courage, or at that moment, the God-given intuition to just fight with her, the whole energy could have just gone way askew. You know, it was a conscious decision. And Swami tells stories about Master. You know, he tells this one story where Master was giving one of his disciples a real tongue-lashing. And he was marching back and forth, and there was a monk sitting at this end of the room, and the nun he was scolding at this end, and he would turn toward her, and he would rail at her, and he would shake his fist. Then he'd turn and kind of wink at the monk, and then he'd turn back, and, you know, it was just appropriate. I mean, a lot of times people are that way with their children, you know. It's appropriate. My sister's there at Kmart, and she's just going to hold it. It wasn't the time to laugh hysterically, she and I did later when she told me the story. It was just too funny afterwards. But now wasn't the moment. At the moment, it had to be absolutely stern. A lot of times with kids, you have to hold that stern look, because if you just let them get away with being cute all the time, they never learn anything. They think they can just do anything because they're cute. You know, sometimes you just have to laugh afterwards in private, but just hold it to the line in the moment. Devi tells this marvelous story about her son, who's in his 30s now. She said, whenever he lied to her, she told it like this. Whenever he would lie to me, I always knew. I still do, she said like that. She said, and he was about 4. And he just walked up to her and he said, I didn't do nothing. And she knew immediately. She said, honey, where did you do nothing? He said, in the closet. And she went in and she said, for reasons of his own, they had a whole shelf full of vitamins and he had opened every bottle and just dumped them on the floor. You know, he just felt to do it for some reason, but he didn't do nothing. Where, honey, where did you do nothing? But you have to hold it just steady and then just follow it through. I remember once we were visiting a friend and they had 2 sons. He must have been about 3 or 4 at the time, and we were just visiting in the living room, and then we all became aware of the fact that nobody knew where he was, and things were real, real quiet. So David volunteered to go look for him, and he went into the kitchen, and then David didn't come back for a really long time. And it turns out he had been cooking. But his way of cooking, he didn't bother with a bowl. He was just dumping a lot of things out onto the counter, including honey and other things like that. And, you know, he was just cooking. And, you know, David had the wherewithal to realize that from his point of view, he was cooking. And so then they just kind of worked together to get it straightened up. Swamiji tells a story in his own childhood of when his family had painted the bathroom. They were making the house prettier. And Swamiji picked up a nail, as he was like a 3 or 4-year-old child, and he thought everything was so beautiful, he wanted to make it beautiful too. And he took the nail and he scratched a big star into the newly painted wall. And his father spanked him. But he felt he'd been so unfairly treated. He said, weeks later, why did you spank me? Because he was just making it beautiful like everyone else. He didn't have the wherewithal as a child to perceive that that was considered to be non-productive. It wasn't vandalism. He was just doing his part. Why would you be punished for that? You see, when you think of it as children, it's an interesting way to look at it. Because oftentimes, it's their intentions that count. Swamiji is a master at relating to us in terms of our intentions. And I recall a situation with a person who was very, very difficult in meetings. And Swami said afterwards, he said, everyone is obnoxious. He said, I know what they're really trying to do. They're just not skilled at presenting their own ideas. She becomes insecure. She fights too hard. She doesn't read other people correctly. He said, but I know what she intends. Other people just read the annoyance that she causes. But he would always see what she intended and would just keep, you know, giving her the right energy to come forward. You see what incredible patience it takes? You see how we have to get our happiness from something other than getting these people all in line for us? But if you can, as much as you can guide your reactions to people this way, appropriate, trusting the right things, being appropriate in your responses, being useful in what you say, and being very wary if your emotions get out of control. Now, don't misread that. That doesn't mean You can't act under the feeling of strong emotion because sometimes you just have to. But you can still be conscious of the fact, I'm very upset now. And you can just put that into the conversation. I'm very upset now, but I have to speak. Or even just within yourself, try to say what you say with the awareness that this is not making me clearer, this is making me less clear. But you can't always just suppress things, and there may never be a good moment. It may always be a bombshell, no matter when you drop it. So you just have to, you know, bite the bullet and go forward. Because that's being appropriate. Because if you suppress it, you're going to lose more than you gain. You see how it all works together? You're trusting that if you're being sincere and doing what's appropriate as best you understand it, that it will all come out the way it has to come out in the end. And it's expansive rather than contractive for you. It'll all come out right in the end. Okay, let's take a little bit of a break. Do we have any questions? Okay, Savina?
I have a question about how do you go from being contractive to expansive if you don't have the option of living in New York?
If you don't have the option of living in New York. The question is, how do you train yourself if you know that you're being, if you know you have to change your behavior into a more expansive way of behavior, how do you do it if you're not living in New York? There's a very simple rule, which is that real change happens incrementally. Change that if you try to, nature never makes sudden leaps. That's how Swamiji has often said it. You know, it's the bud, and the bud gradually grows, and then it opens into the flower. It doesn't go from just being this tiny little thing to being a full rose. We have apple trees in the backyard of the house where we're now living, and I've never watched fruit grow the way I've watched this fruit grow because it's literally right outside my kitchen window. And we have a Myers lemon tree. And so, you know, these little lemons, they're just this little green dot. And I'm just watching them every day. They just get bigger and bigger. Now, it's an obvious thing to say that nature doesn't make sudden leaps. But when you watch what it really takes, you know, where the lemon starts and where the lemon ends up, you realize that's how everything in nature works. And so we have these qualities of consciousness, and we imagine that we can just get rid of them in a second. And partly, how would I say it? Our lack of serious intent to actually get rid of them often presents itself to us by this desire for something dramatic. And we constantly do impractical, dramatic things that don't work, and then we get to say, see, it's more than I can do. Because the way change really happens is by the patient, constant application of willpower. Just the steady, patient application of willpower. And just by recognizing that it took me a long time, you know, we spend incarnations reaching this point. And this is a very complex web. And to redirect it, it's like if you're going in a car and you're riding 100 miles an hour and you realize that, you know, you need to slow down because you have to make a turn. It just takes a little time. You have to withdraw from the accelerator. The momentum takes a little while. You have to get yourself into the right lane. You have to move over there. You can't just go from, oh, I need to make a turn, from going 100 miles an hour. You have to do all the steps in between, and then you can move off. So if you say, I have this quality of, I recognize that I'm too fear-oriented, I'm not frank with people, whatever, however you might articulate it, then you need to recognize, first of all, that in order to transform ourselves, we need patience. And you have to have the self-acceptance that recognizes that change happens slowly. Then the aphorism to use is this one, which is called practice when it's easier. And that's not a cop-out. I have really observed in myself and in others that when you have some gigantic fault that's really polluting your life, it usually has lots of little offshoots. And it's very difficult to grasp the trunk of the tree and pull it up. But you can start snipping away at the branches. And so you find, you begin to think of all the non... See, when I was in New York, what I really needed to do was I needed to put my relationship with my then husband on a more honest basis, which was beyond my capacity even to imagine what to speak of acting on. So what I did was I put my relationship with taxi drivers and grocery clerks and, you know, produce merchants, and I began to put all those relationships on a more honest basis, and it began to train me for the time when I could really confront the big problem, which was my lack of courage in the midst of that relationship. But there was just no possibility that I could have confronted the relationship, so I practiced for a long time when it was easier, and I began to get into the flow of how I'm supposed to behave. So you have to start realizing that there's no time, if it's a real flaw that you really know is central to your nature, you have to give up your tolerance for it in small ways. That's often the way we rationalize, oh, this doesn't matter, you know, that's the area that I really need to work on. No, you need to practice when it's easier. You need to train your awareness and your natural response, and you need to work when there's not a lot of jeopardy so you can overcome your fear. You need to see that it will work out if I behave in the right way. You need to do that which is doable. See, if you're sincere about wanting to change, you do everything you can rather than polarizing the situation and saying, oh, it's too much for me, I can't do anything about it. Does that make sense? And it really makes almost no difference where you start, and it makes almost no difference what you do as long as it's in the right direction. Because once you start moving in the right direction, I put it to a woman this way, in her case, she had a whole family situation with children and a husband, and she was out of integrity with herself. And she, for a long time, she kept trying to get the husband to change and the children to be different, and none of them were the slightest bit interested because it wasn't their reality. But what we discussed was, I pointed out to her that a family especially, it's like a solar system. But everybody's life, you're like a solar system, and you have the centrifugal force and the gravity, and everything's all playing against itself to hold all the pieces in orbit. And whatever habitual magnetism you're putting out is holding a lot of other things in orbit. Begin to shift your magnetism, and then everybody's orbits have to change. And so you may think it's more than you can actually influence, but you can't influence them. But if you begin to put yourself in right alignment, first internally and then externally to whatever extent is correct and doable, and everything else will align itself. And part of that is to recognize, in her particular case, her family wasn't the slightest bit interested in making the changes she wanted them to change. It was she herself needed to come into a greater state of happiness, a greater state of independence, a less desire for them to approve and share her interests, more willingness just to go on alone. Nobody was actually stopping her from doing anything. But the fact that they weren't going along with her made her feel stymied. There was no reason for that. It was just a thought form. But, you know, it was just keeping everything in a certain relationship. She needed to change that magnetism. And actually, when she did, everything began to balance out better. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, this whole question, practice when it's easier, I'll give you the story. This is in my book, but I'll just mention it here. I used to have a conundrum because I was born in a Jewish family right after World War II. And I just used to think about being in a concentration camp a lot. I don't think I died in a concentration camp, but I think I have been dangerous to society on many occasions, and I believe that I have been swept up and imprisoned. You know, not that I don't put tremendous faith in psychics, but this one person who was psychic once essentially said to me that I have used the gift of gab to persuade people to lots of wrong things over, you know, many lifetimes. She actually said, I helped start the French Revolution, was what she said. I don't know whether I did or not, but it's apocryphal if not true. And one of the reasons I have to repeat these teachings over and over is I have to expiate that karma. I have to use this gift now to help bring people to something that's true and not just to whatever fool idea I have. And I know just that I have been a revolutionary and been thrown in prison lots of times, and I didn't like it. So I used to think about being in this concentration camp, and I used to actually have this, I had this moral conundrum. I must have died in this situation at least once, probably repeatedly. I thought, if I'm standing there, they're doing the roll call, and the guard starts brutalizing the person next to me, do I interfere, even if to do so would be to sacrifice my life, or do I just stand there and let that person be hurt? It really disturbed me. I didn't know how to answer that. And finally, I had the opportunity to ask Swami that question in some satsang where he said, does anyone have questions? Yes, sir, I have a question. And I explained it to him. And he said, well, it is difficult to know. He said, because perhaps by interfering, not only would you lose your life, but perhaps you would bring down the anger of all the prison authorities, and maybe everyone would be hurt and much more damage would be caused. You know, just all of those different thoughts. He said, so what you're actually asking is how to know in a moment of crisis what God's will is. Isn't that an interesting thing? Because that's really what he's saying. How to have the intuition in that moment to know what the right thing to do is. And that was when he said to me, practice when it is easier. He said, practice making all your decisions by stopping and inwardly asking that question, Divine Mother, what do you want me to do? Master, what's the right thing to do here? And then he said, it will become your habitual response to life. And then in that very pressured moment, you will simply know, because you have trained yourself to turn that way. Wasn't that just an extraordinary answer? So far beyond what I had even imagined was possible. And this was a very universal principle that I've realized applies to everything. If you practice when it's easier, gradually easier becomes more and more difficult until you have really expanded your consciousness to what you're trying to accomplish. To get from here to there is a series of steps. And the more we just sit and think, oh, if only I was younger, if only I hadn't done that, if only it wasn't so difficult. That was once I said to Swamiji, essentially what I said, oh, if only life were easier, it would be easier. He didn't even dignify it with a response. He didn't even dignify it with an expression. He just looked at me absolutely without saying anything. He just let the sheer stupidity of my own remark just... You know, he just let it sit there. It just was beneath comment. It was beneath reaction. Until I just heard myself and I thought, what am I thinking? You know, but I had just spun myself out to the point where I just wanted to be rescued. Nobody's going to rescue you. That's the other thing. I mean, talking about just starting to take a step. It's a phrase. I think Swami uses it in one of his commentaries because, you know, there's so many golden phrases. He basically said so many people just go through their life waiting to be rescued. It's quite a comment if you meditate on it. It came to me extremely vividly after David and I had been living here in Palo Alto about 15 years. You know, we've been here 20 years. That's an enormously long time. It's a great proportion of some of your lives. I don't think it's all of any of your lives, but for some of you, it's a high proportion of it. And yet, my first home was Ananda Village. And the first 16 years, it wasn't merely that I was in Ananda Village, but I lived in the same community Swami Kriyananda lived in. And since 1980, whatever, 20 years ago, I haven't. So there's always been the thought in my mind, there used to be the thought in my mind that someday I would live again in the same community that he lived in. Or that, you know, we helped start this community. I always thought we'd help start quite a few. I didn't really realize we'd only ever really help start this one. My mental picture was very different than the way these last 20 years have been. It's been perfectly fine, but it was always different. And three times, twice by Swami's intention and the third time by a misunderstanding, he thought we were volunteering to leave. We thought he was trying to transfer us. But three times we thought we were going to leave here by his instruction. And then after the third time, when all the confusion settled, he basically said to us, you know, pick out your gravesite. Because I don't think you're ever going anywhere. I think this is just where you're going to stay. Because just in the natural order of things, it just makes sense for us to stay here. We've more or less created this in the shape of our own personalities, and it becomes more and more difficult to replace us, among other things. And in the whole Ananda world, where else would we go that would be better for us? Because that's the most important consideration, is the individual. It was amazing to me. I don't know how many years ago this was, maybe 5, 6, 7, the extent to which I was still waiting to be rescued. I wasn't unhappy or anything like that, but so many levels of my mind were just not dealing with things because I assumed that sooner or later I could just walk away from them. Whoa, that was so interesting, waiting to be rescued. I mean, from cleaning out a closet to harmonizing a relationship to solving a particular problem that had to be solved, to finding something that would grow in that corner of the garden instead of just leaving it like that. Always in the back of my mind was the thought, I'm just going to walk away from this someday. I'm never really going to have to deal with it. Waiting to be rescued. In Stephen Levine's instructions for coping with terminal illness, when they have these seminars that they would give where they would gather people together who are terminally ill, one of the exercises that they would do is they would make two lists. The first list would be all the things that they're not going to get to do because they're going to die. You know, I'll never see my daughter's wedding. I'll never hold my grandchild. You know, I'll never get married. I'll never have a child. Whatever the list is, because now that I have terminal cancer, I'm going to die in 2 years or 1 year. All these things I'm not going to get to do. And, you know, you think, well, that's so important. You have to grieve. And then you make another list, which is all the things that you get to avoid because you're going to die. Whatever it might be. I'm never going to have to pay off my credit card debt. I'm never going to have to get married. I'm never going to have to solve my son's drug problem. You know, whatever it might be. But actually, the list you really work with is that list. Because it's the thought form of waiting to be rescued. That's the one that's so karmically... You know, what you're going to miss out on, of course, is also important, but the real debilitating one is the waiting to be rescued one, or the joy at being rescued. I played that exercise out for myself. It was really interesting. What it showed me was that my belief in reincarnation is so deep in me, and my belief now that death is no respite, because I just couldn't put anything on that list, because dying is not going to rescue you from anything. Because whatever your consciousness is that's disturbing now you now is going to keep disturbing you, period. You know, your name may change, the players in the play may change their costumes. Whatever is disturbing you in your consciousness will keep disturbing you, period. It's the only certainty. So if not now, when? And that's part of what gets you really practical about learning to get along with people, learning to get along with yourself, learning to act on these things and changing things, is there is no alternative. If this is making me miserable, it's just going to keep making me miserable. How long do I want to suffer? You know, just this thought that if I just keep trying to get that person to do what I want them to do, eventually they will. As long as you keep thinking that, you will suffer. Maybe eventually they will change, but what's disturbing you is this thought, you know, that I just don't want to face this, I don't want to face that, I don't want to face this, sooner or later. But you have to practice when it's easier. Don't make a big list of all the big mountains that you can't. As I say, that's just a way of pretending that you're serious, but not actually being serious. It took me a long time to see that in myself. I would polarize the discussion. Oh, I so want to, but I can't. And then I had all the satisfaction of saying, I so want to, and all the relief of saying, but I can't. Because I wasn't looking at what I could do. I was just focusing on what I can't do. Just look at what you can do. In a different context entirely, this woman came to me once, and she had, I don't know what her problems were, but they were enormous. They were just such a mess. And she was so, you know, they were financial, they were relationships, they were everything. She had so many problems. And they were insoluble, most of them. I mean, they were just way beyond her to solve. But her biggest problem was that she didn't have any positive magnetism. And without positive magnetism, you can't do anything. So I said to her, okay, let's just stop for a minute. Just look over the whole panorama of your life and tell me, is there anything you can think of doing that lifts your spirits and makes you feel better? She stopped for a moment. She said, I love to ride my bicycle. I said, forget everything, just ride your bicycle. I said, whenever you become anxious about any of these problems, get on your bicycle. And it just was so wacky, she just said, okay. And she really literally started doing it. Every time she got anxious or started worrying, she just got on her bicycle. And what happened was she kept generating positive magnetism. And a couple of weeks later, she came back. And not only did she look better and feel better, but when she would ride her bicycle, new ideas would come to her that she hadn't thought of before because she was in a positive flow of energy. Swamiji, to me once, just said very simply, you know, if you don't have positive magnetism, you can't do anything. As the way he put it was, you don't necessarily do, in my case, this was when I was learning not to be a martyr. I just had a limit. And when I pushed past that limit, I might still be doing things, but my magnetism was not good. And he said, you don't necessarily do more good by doing more. Because it's the magnetism you're putting out that really solves problems and makes things work. And that's always been my guideline. You know, once I feel that my magnetism has gotten bad, I just pull back. Because I know I'm not doing any good at that point. I mean, sometimes you have to go forward, but then you figure out how to go forward with good magnetism. Does that make sense? So where did that play in? That plays into practice when it's easier. If contemplating what's really big in your life exhausts you, don't think about it. Really, don't. Anything that poisons your energy, just put it aside. Run away from it. Because if you can keep your energy upbeat and positive, then all those problems will take care of themselves, because that's how it all works. And because we're talking about relationships with people, do that for other people. Just, you know, aren't there people in your lives? I have this one wonderful friend at Ananda. Whenever I'm with her, I just feel better. You know, she doesn't particularly give me wonderful advice or anything, but she loves me. She really loves me. And she just accepts me, and I just can't get enough of her company. And it's so palpable to me when I'm with her. And it just made me realize, wouldn't it be nice to be that kind of friend to others? You know, all this advice and stuff, what good does it do? Brenda has observed and has commented that a great deal of what I'm saying is about self-honesty and introspection. Yes, there you have it. You know, the universe is one, others are an illusion. I don't mean that they don't exist, they do, but there's only one reality, which is your own consciousness. Every relationship difficulty originates with you, me, with oneself. And most of the difficulties I observe is that people don't know themselves. If you know yourself really well and are very honest about yourself, you know, not everybody's nice and you still have trouble and fights and enemies, but everything is completely different. You just know your reality. You move in it. You're right. Absolutely. I mean, I can think of maybe one or two divorces I've seen that were actually about genuine incompatibility. All the others were about lack of self-understanding. Lack of self-understanding followed by lack of self-control. I mean, there have been incompatible, probably more than two. But it's just, and I mean, nothing can be done about it. That's what Swami said to me when I got divorced. You've learned, you've gone as far as you can go. You're just not capable of going any farther. You have to stop and learn lessons in another way before you can ever resolve this anymore. But it was really just about self. Yeah, honest introspection. That's why Swami behaves so perfectly with people. He knows himself. He has no agenda. He's just very clear within himself. And when you understand yourself, you understand others. I used to be so overblunt with people. And then it took me so much longer than I'm proud to say to admit how easily I got my own feelings hurt and how frank statements from others just devastated me. Whatever made me think that others enjoyed it from me? What a crazy idea. I was listening once to a Sunday sermon of mine. This was like, again, I know the house we were living in, so it was about 24 years ago. I was listening to a Sunday sermon, and it was so unpleasant. She was just shaking her finger at those people and just scolding them like this. I couldn't listen to it. And then I thought, God, does anybody else enjoy it? They must hate it as much as I do, because the whole tone of it was... And then I realized I was talking to myself. That was my way of working with myself. Get in line, girl! And I thought, it hasn't worked for me. Why would it work for them? You know, it was so dumb. It took me so long to figure that out. I used to think... This is how I finally characterized it to myself. I used to think that there was a much better version of myself that was just sort of locked in a closet somewhere, and if I kept yelling at this one, then she would finally say, ha ha, April Fools, and she'd go and get the better one. You know, and then one wonderful, awful day, I realized that this was it. You know, that the only one there was this one. And that no amount of just exhorting her to go away and bring in the better one was ever going to produce a better one, that this was it. That was a real big day. Just ka-thunk. And then I had to think, God, well, if this is who we really are, then we better start working in a realistic manner with this person. And that's when I began to realize, you know, just she, meaning me, she's not going to respond to just constantly being badgered. Nobody responds to constantly being badgered. Just be a little nicer to her. Be a little more patient, a little kinder. Have a little more respect for her. Emphasize her good points. I started just treating myself. I thought of a friend of mine with whom I happened to have a very, very accepting relationship. Girl was filled with flaws. She was one of my Scorpio friends. She was tough. But I don't know why. I just loved her. She really just couldn't do anything that would really upset me, no matter what she did. I just really loved her. I started pretending that I was her. It worked wonders because I knew how to be encouraging and unconditionally accepting with her. So when I would consider myself and my own realities, I would pretend it was her presenting herself to me. And then I would immediately know how to respond. Whereas when it was me presenting myself to me, I didn't do anything that was useful. But with her, I did a lot of useful things. I gave her good advice, and I responded to her in ways that really helped. It completely just turned my energy around. I started emphasizing the positive. I was married by then. I started saying things to David like, you know, I'm really a very nice person. He would look at me like, what is wrong with you? But I was so accustomed to orienting myself toward my flaws that I actually had forgotten that I was a very nice person. But, you know, that would what I would say to my girlfriend when she would come to me with this exaggerated sense of catastrophe about some minor shortcoming. I would say, but you're a wonderful person. And I would list out all her good qualities and, you know, it would help put her in balance. So I started just reminding myself that I was a very nice person, a little short-tempered sometimes, a little reactive, could be a little sharp tongue. All those things were true, but overall, very nice person. But I started getting along a lot better with the world around me when I started getting along with myself better. And the self-honesty was the patient acceptance of my shortcomings. It's just what we have to work with. You see, we try to expunge it in others because it's really us that we're so nervous about. John.
There's a tribe back in Africa that when a member of the tribe did something inappropriate, what they typically did was get that person in front of the council of elders or leaders, and that person, or rather the council, would then proceed to name all the wonderful qualities about that person and all the things that that person has done or participated in the community. And that was that.
That Isn't was that an interesting thought? I mean, you have to have a very cohesive society to to deal with wrongdoing like that. But you know, to a very large extent, John, what you describe is how Ananda works. Whereas in society, when someone makes a mistake, there's a tendency for everybody to jump on them and knock them down. Interestingly, when Ananda was involved in the second dimension of the lawsuits that we were involved in, it involved a man who'd had an affair, who was a married man, and he had an affair. And then that whole, and then he repudiated her and stayed with his wife, which was all the right decision. She, the woman scorned, became enraged, filed a sexual harassment lawsuit, which escalated because of other things that were going on. But that was the simple beginning of it. And in the twisted way of our culture, see, our response to him was to help him. First of all, he'd slipped, but he'd made the right decision, which was in. It's not that divorce is unthinkable, even within Ananda at all. In this case, it was definitely the right decision, though. She was not a suitable woman, as became obvious, et cetera, et cetera. So we stood by him. Then it comes out in the courts, the way they played it out, because Ananda itself went on trial. You have no code of conduct. You have no consequences. You have no policy against these things. And they were just trying to make us seem like a terrible organization, because instead of smashing the man and kicking him out, we had just supported him and allowed him to continue. And he was even in a leadership role, and we hadn't taken that away from him. And I remember one Sunday service when I sort of began to see all this. I said, listen to what's happening. Is that we're being vilified because we're kind and supportive. And I said, I'd just rather go down in flames. Who cares? And that's exactly what was happening, because that's how people imagine that you help someone. is by smashing them. They're just afraid. They're afraid of love. They're afraid of support. They're afraid of themselves. They're afraid of human relationships. This is what makes Ananda what it is. And you're talking about in cultures that are solid. That's, of course, how people behave. This is even in, you know, if your child makes a mistake, he doesn't cease to be your son. If somebody is unrepentant and is a real danger to society, you have to respond appropriately. But God knows if you make a mistake and you come to those you love and say, I was wrong, help me. How else could you respond? But our society is so twisted. Really. Okay, anything else? We tried to say in that particular situation, this was not exceptional. This is, you know, 25 years of Ananda. We've always stuck by each other. That's what makes us great, not what makes us weak. Don't be absurd. Now the world is so confused, you can't behave person to person. It's just you and all the lawyers every time anything happens. Awful. We just have to plant our feet and say, no. I'm just waiting for the people's rebellion. You know? No. We're going to stand by each other and live rightly. That's what Ananda's doing. We're setting an example of strength and dharma. And every one of us here, standing here, that's what we're here to do. That's what I'm talking about. Maybe there's nothing else I have to say. There's always so much more. But any other questions or thoughts? The hour is late. Okay, I think we finished. All right, God bless you.